Our text will be Hebrews chapter 11, if you have a Bible with you and want to join me there. Do you know someone in your life who is brilliant, but maybe doesn't have a lot of common sense? Somebody who has all sorts of skills and abilities and maybe a very quick mind to grasp concepts and maybe to invent things and but they have trouble navigating life and relationships. I was reading a little bit about Einstein this week in a series of, he had three marriages and was estranged from his kids in some ways, even while they were very young. It's kind of an interesting story. So many great accomplishments and so many wonderful things, and yet maybe in some regard had some trouble bringing together all of that knowledge into life. And the reality is I find myself there a lot of the times, and we know a lot about truth and about doctrine, and especially like me, if you've grown up in the church. But even if you haven't, you could probably come up with a pretty good list. Tell me about God and tell me about Jesus, and you'd be able to state a lot of true things. And yet we oftentimes have trouble sort of living those things, don't we? And so the text before me is of interest in that regard, because at this point in the letter, the author camps out for pretty much the entirety of chapter 11, and he gives us examples of faith in real life, right? What this actually looks like and how it fleshes itself out. And we get some sort of models and templates that we can look at and say, oh yeah, that's how it works. And that's the type of stuff that I need to work through. And that's how I need to trust God in circumstances like that, right? So so thankful that God in His grace doesn't give us just cold hard facts, not just simply doctrine, but He gives us life and He gives us testimonials and He gives us examples that we can look at. So it's an exciting place in the book of Hebrews. Just to set the stage for us again, the first 10 chapters, the 9 chapters, part of chapter 10, were really focused on doctrine. The author is affirming and asserting and contending for the superiority or the supremacy of Jesus Christ. And so he's talking about how Jesus is superior to the angels, and in the Jewish context, that would have been one of the things, sort of the levels of importance and value and power, and the angels are up the ticker on that, right? And he talked to them about Jesus in comparison with all of the other prophets, a long line of godly individuals who had come from Moses and Abraham and on down through the years, and Samuel, and the author says, no, Jesus is better than the angels. Jesus is better than even the greatest of the prophets. And he goes through, and all the different things that would have been part of their Jewish, these were Jewish believers, and all the things that would have been part of their framework, the temple, and even the Temple Mount, and the priests, and the sacrifices. And Jesus is better than all of those things. And so he unpacks that in these opening chapters, the supremacy of Christ. And then chapter 10, some very sort of practical exhortations. He's calling them to faith. He's calling them to hang on. Some of these individuals were being persecuted because of their faith in Jesus Christ. They had been ostracized from their families in many cases. Many of them had experienced physical persecution or had their homes, their possessions taken from them. And they were really struggling to keep believing in Jesus when their circumstances seemed to be crumbling around them. And so in chapter 10, He's urging them on and even reminding them of the importance of the church. Don't forsake fellowshipping together, but spur one another on towards love and good works. And even more as you see the day approaching, the idea being that things are getting worse in our world. And that becomes increasingly important for us to be putting ourselves in a context where we have people speaking truth to us and continuing to challenge our faulty worldviews, right? When we get in a funk and we have trouble getting out, and we need to be putting ourselves in places where our faith is going to be built up. So he's calling them to faith. And then into chapter 11, those first few verses of chapter 11, which Scott unpacked for us last week, talks about the nature of faith. What are we really talking about here when we say we need to live by faith? And he says that faith is not just sort of, I hope, but faith is something very solid. We don't just have faith in like a dream, but we have faith in God and in his revealed word and his promises. And so there's something very stable in the midst of, you know, whatever's going on with my stomach and whatever I ate last night and how I happen to feel this morning, and I have a headache, and the shifting sands of culture and what the world tells us is important. Faith is solid. That's what he's telling us there in Hebrews 11, verse 1. And he talks about how faith is the means by which we gain God's commendation. It's the way that we are able to be right with God. We are saved by grace through faith. And so when we respond to God's grace and we trust him and we cast ourselves upon him, that's the means by which we earn God's commendation. We come to peace with him. So there in those opening verses, he just unpacks again the importance of faith. And then in verses 4 and following, again, we just see now faith in real life. We see what it looks like. And a great, great section for us to focus on this morning. And in some key areas, we get a glimpse of what we're talking about when we talk about faith. And by God's grace, we're praying that God will give us the ability to not just have knowledge, not just have doctrine, but to be able to bring that to bear in real life, that we would live by faith, right? So we're going to look at three individuals in these few verses, verses 4 through 7, and three different arenas in which we need to live by faith. First, we should worship by faith. We should worship by faith. I got to turn it on. That would help. There we go. We should worship by faith. And that's this first verse here, which features Abel from Genesis chapter 4. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts. And through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. So we should worship by faith. By faith, Abel offered a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain. Just trying to sort of give us the crux of what Abel did here that's being highlighted. He offered a sacrifice. And he offered a sacrifice, an appropriate sacrifice, and one that was able to be received by God. And there's a comparison point, of course, because we have not only Abel in view here, but we have Cain. So we're not going to go back to a longer passage there in Genesis 4, but I want to set the stage for us. Very early in biblical history, Cain and Abel were two of the children of Adam and Eve. So the first humans that God created, they had a number of children, but two of them were Cain and Abel. So we're very early in the biblical story. And there comes a time where they both come to make an offering. We're not given any details. It appears that maybe there was some sort of a day established. Maybe it was an annual or a monthly feast or something where something that brought both of them into view here. They're both coming to offer a sacrifice. Cain is a farmer by vocation. So Cain went out into his fields And he gathered some of his crops, and he put them on the altar to offer to God. Abel was a shepherd. He kept livestock, and so he selected one of his sheep. The text says that he selected from the fat portions. He selected one of the very best of his sheep, and he slaughtered that animal, spilled its blood, and put that animal on the altar. So that's the comparison point. And here we have that Abel offered a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain. Now, we don't really know much about the background. Again, I mentioned to you that there's not much context here. It's just Adam and Eve, and now we're right into Cain and Abel, Genesis chapter 4. So we don't know how much they knew. Did they have some sort of written instruction about, here's the guidelines, sacrifices for dummies, steps 1, 2, and 3. We don't know. But we do know that Abel offered this sacrifice by faith, which doesn't mean that he just was like, vegetables or a sheep, vegetables or a sheep, vegetables or a sheep, a sheep, a sheep, a sheep. I think the sheep is what I'm feeling right now. We have sometimes these sort of fuzzy, mystical notions of faith and attempting something that no one's ever done before, and I'm doing it by faith. But that's not the idea. The idea is that Abel had some revelation from God and he believed God. So we don't know if there was specific instruction. At the very least, Abel had a pattern that had been established in the Garden of Eden with his parents, Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve sinned. They ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And they gathered fig leaves and tried to put together clothing because they all of a sudden were guilty and they were ashamed and they were afraid and they tried to cover themselves. And God comes and slaughters an animal and clothes them in sheepskins. So whether the instruction was overt or not, Abel knew something about God, and he knew something about sin, and he knew something about atonement, or how sin was to be paid for and made right. And Abel acted on the basis of faith, and he offered his sacrifice. Cain, again, we're not given details as to his mindset. It could have been that he just thought that the vegetables were aesthetically pleasing. Maybe he gathered a cucumber and a tomato. I know it's not a vegetable, but it's red. And maybe a squash was thrown in there as well, in the cornucopia. And it was a beautiful presentation. Maybe that's part of what was going on in Cain's mind. It could be that Cain was not going to give his brother the satisfaction. I am not going to take my vegetables and go over and barter for a sheep. Why is his occupation better than mine? Whatever it was, Cain was offering an offering not on faith in the revealed nature of God, but he was offering an offering based on his own intuition. He was approaching God on his own terms. And God accepted Abel's offering and did not accept Cain's offering. So God commended. Here's this theme that was begun in verses 1 through 3, which Scott dealt with last week again, of faith and how faith is the means by which we are commended by God. The author carries that theme through here. God commended Abel as righteous by accepting his sacrifice. So how do we know that Abel received God's approval? We know it because he accepted Abel's sacrifice. That's another interesting detail, that even in Genesis 4, we're not really told how God expressed his approval. But both Cain and Abel, the text makes it very clear, they both knew that Abel's offering had been accepted and Cain's had not. Jewish tradition says that God sent down fire and consumed Abel's offering. and God left Cain's offering sitting on the altar. We don't know if that's how it went down, but something overt happened. They both knew that God had accepted Abel's offering and had not accepted Cain's offering. And by this means, Abel was identified as righteous. Well, we're going to see this theme popping up a little bit more even in this text, but we see it for the first time here. Matthew 23, the texts I give you there, the New Testament texts, also reference Abel, and they recognize him as righteous Abel. This is his nickname, righteous Abel. The text says it wasn't that he was just so perfect and did all these wonderful things. He obeyed God. He acted in faith, and God recognized him, pronounced him righteous. Right? This is Abraham. You know the account? Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him for righteousness. Right? Abraham believed God, and God marked it down on Abraham's account, righteous. Abel's the same way. Abel believed God, he trusted God, he approached God on God's terms, and God marked him down as righteous, credited him as righteous. And Abel continues to speak to us today about how we should approach God. Abel's life was cut short. If you know the story, if you know the rest of Genesis chapter 4, you find that Cain was angry. Cain was angry because his sacrifice had not been accepted. His offering had not been accepted. He was primarily angry at God, but he takes out his anger on his brother Abel, and he kills him. Cold-blooded murder. One generation removed from creation, and we have murder. And we're told that God comes to Cain and says to Cain, "Your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground." Abel does a lot of talking even when he's not alive. You get this theme? And Abel's blood is crying out, and Cain comes under judgment. And I want to draw attention to this because I think on the surface we say, man, it didn't work out very well for Abel, right? Here he obeys God, he acts in faith, and what's he get for it, you know? He gets a short life. And Cain goes on to live many more years, and we read all about his descendants and yada, yada, yada. This doesn't seem very fair. But when you take a closer look at the text, Cain comes under God's judgment. God comes to him, says, "Your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground." And he puts Cain out of his presence. And Cain, the cold-blooded murderer, is blubbering like a baby because God's punishment is unthinkable. And all of a sudden, he understands what it is to be put out of the presence of God. So Abel's the winner. I mean, Abel is the winner. Abel's life is cut short, but he is at peace with God. To this day, he is at peace with God. And Cain, all indications are, is separated from God for all of eternity. And Abel's voice speaks down through the centuries about how we are to approach God. There is one way to approach God. We don't approach God on your own terms. You might try, but you will not succeed. You might try to put vegetables on the altar. You might try to say, "These are my terms." But there is one way to approach God, and that is through the shedding of blood. And specifically, the blood of God's Son, the Lamb of God, Jesus Christ. That is the means of salvation. God's revealed template for how we can come to Him. And this text, and Abel's voice, tells us that we must, by faith, worship God. Go in real life and how he conducted his worship. So it's kind of in vogue today to be rogue or maverick, even the new Star Wars theme, right? The rogue terminology. But there are no rogues in God's kingdom. We approach God only through Jesus. So we should worship by faith. When it comes to how we approach God and engage in worship, we need to do it in accordance with what God has said. We need to believe His revelation to us. Secondly, we should walk by faith. We should walk by faith. And here we look into chapter 11, verse 5. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death. And he was not found because God had taken him. Now, before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. So we should walk by faith. By faith, Enoch walked with God. Now, there's a textual issue here that I want to just draw your attention to as we pause here. If we go back to Genesis 5, we have a very brief snippet about Enoch. If I were to quiz you on what you know about Enoch, you probably don't know very much, if anything. And there's not much to know. We have just a few verses in Genesis 5. So I want to look back at the original text here. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he fathered Methuselah. Enoch walked with God after he fathered Methuselah 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus, all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. So there's the body of work regarding Enoch. Actually, there's one other New Testament passage we'll look at, but this is really all we know of background, history, lifestyle, and it's set in the context of genealogy. So you're just reading about people and how long they lived and who their child was and on and on and on. But when you look more closely, you'll find that there's a designation given to Enoch that he walked with God twice. It doesn't appear as a description of anyone else in those genealogies, but only Enoch. So in a very subtle way, the text highlights this fact about Enoch, that he walked with God. So that's the Hebrew text. Now, in the 3rd century BC, before the time of Christ, before the New Testament was written, the Hebrew Old Testament was translated into Greek, the language of the day. And we call that the Septuagint, sort of the formal name for that Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. When they did that translation, they translated this passage, Genesis 5, by saying that Enoch pleased God twice. Instead of saying that he walked with God, it says that he pleased God. My point is simply this, that to walk with God is to please God. That's how they translated that concept. It was to be in fellowship with Him. It was to be in alignment with Him. It was to value the things that God values. It's to love the things that God loves and to hate the things that God hates, to be step for step, pace for pace with God. That's what it means when it tells us in Genesis 5 that he walked with God. And that's when the author of the Hebrews quotes out of that text, he's quoting the Greek translation. So he says it that Enoch pleased God. He was commended as having pleased God. He walked with God. There's one other text here that I mentioned to you that references Enoch. Jude 14. It was also about these that Enoch, the seventh from Adam, prophesied, saying, "Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000s of his holy ones to execute judgment on all and to convict all the ungodly of their deeds of ungodliness that they have committed in such an ungodly way and of all the harsh things that ungodly sinners have spoken against them. So here's another reference to Enoch, this obscure character. Not only did Enoch was he aligned with God in terms of his lifestyle? Matter of fact, the text specifies for 300 years he walked with God. He pursued God. He cultivated a relationship with God. But part of that, another facet of that, was that he had a very clear moral compass. Right? He was speaking about things that were happening in his day that were wrong. He understood the difference between right and wrong. And he lived at a time when it was not easy to walk with God. Right? And certainly this text reveals that to us. He was living at a time when people were engaged in great evil and violence. So this is Enoch. He walked with God and shows us how to walk with God. God commended Enoch by taking him directly into his presence. The text is rather cryptic about that. The notion there is not just that he disappeared, but that he was transferred from the realm of this earth into God's realm, right, into heaven. Warren Wiersbe, a preacher from another generation, drew attention to the fact that it wasn't much of a transition. You know, I mean, that's kind of the point, I think, here, that Enoch was in such harmony with God that God just said, hey, why don't you just come be with me? and he escaped death. He didn't have to die. One of only two individuals, Elijah and Enoch. These are the two that escaped death. I hope to be number three, right? And if Christ returns, we'll have that joy. But otherwise, everybody else faces death, but not Enoch. God, that's how we know that God commended him, is because he just took him, transferred him directly to heaven without having to experience death. And all those who seek God will be rewarded. Notice the transition. We get a look behind the curtain here in verse 6. We have Enoch's story, but then sort of a principle that flows out of that. End of verse 5. Now before he, Enoch, was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. Verse 6, and without faith, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. So, we're told that he pleased God or that he walked with God. The text in Genesis 5 doesn't really say overtly that he had faith. But the author here is helping us to connect the dots. Enoch pleased God, he walked with God, and he did that by faith. Because without faith, it is impossible to please God. It's impossible to walk with him. And then he unpacks what that involves. It not only involves in faith in the existence of God, that certainly is necessary and foundational, but it involves a faith in the character, the moral character and nature of God. You believe not only that he exists, but that he rewards those who seek him. So Enoch had this confidence in the nature of God. He didn't have a scripture to go back to. He had some oral tradition that had been passed down to him. He knew the stories and the accounts from Adam and Eve and Abel. But he knew enough to know what God was like. He knew that God had pursued Adam and Eve in the garden after sin, right? He knew this. We're not told that God ever spoke audibly to Enoch. There's nothing miraculous that happened during his life. He didn't have any, you know, burning bush experience. But for 300 years, in the midst of a godless culture, he pursued God. believing that God rewards those who seek after him. And notice the shift in pronouns here. It's talking about he, Enoch, in verse 5. But then verse 6, and without faith it is impossible to please God, for whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. That was Enoch's experience, but it is also can be our experience if we walk with God day by day. No cataclysmic experiences, but going to work, working with my kids, obeying God every step of sharing my faith in the workplace, making moral decisions in the context of my daily life, walking with God, seeking to have his values be my values, seeking the things that he loves. I want to be the things that I love. And this is the story of Enoch, of how to walk with God by faith. And it can be our story as well. Where's the treasure you're pursuing? Some of you are trying to get into an Ivy League school. If you could just have good enough grades to get into that type of school, right? That would be it right there. Some of you are pursuing a higher position at work, maybe a six-figure salary. Some of you are pursuing a girl. Some of you are. Some of you need to be. Sorry about that. That just slipped out. I was in a workshop yesterday at the Church Ministries Conference about guys who don't become men. Sorry, it's another message for another day. Some are pursuing athletic prowess. Some of you are pursuing the next level on Game of Thrones. Whatever that is. But where are those who are seeking God? Who are pursuing him? It's worth it. God rewards those who seek after him. And we learn something of not only how we should worship by faith, but we learn that we should walk by faith. And finally, time is almost gone. We learn how we should work by faith. Here's verse 7. By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear, constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this, he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. We should work by faith. By faith, Noah responded to God's warning and built an ark. He spent 120 years building a huge boat in the middle of the desert. It's a real godly endeavor, isn't it? It is if that's what God calls you to do. Right? We sometimes make these distinctions between spiritual vocations and secular vocations, and we do a bad job at all of that. We've got a lot to learn to realize that God is concerned about every aspect of our lives. Our faith is not a weekend endeavor. It's not something you do on Sunday. It's something that God demands of our entire lives. And here we have Noah exerting himself over 120 years in faith that God was going to do what God said he was going to do. He was going to bring a cataclysmic judgment. There's a few things the text draws our attention to, and I will draw your attention to this morning. First of all, he, Noah, responded even though there was nothing in his circumstances to confirm that what God said was true. The text says it. You see it there? By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events as yet unseen. So, this is a huge boat. This is like 1.5 football fields long, right? Huge boat. And again, in no proximity to water anywhere. Tigris, Euphrates rivers were probably in proximity, but this boat would not have been going down the Tigris or the Euphrates. It's a huge boat. So, like, not having a capacity to see how this is all going to come together, right? How did this make sense? And it had never rained. It had never rained at that point in human history. In the original creation, there was a vapor canopy, a greenhouse effect, as it were, in which the world was watered through springs and through the dew. And that's why you find dinosaurs, with lush vegetation in their stomachs in polar regions, because the whole world was a common temperature. That's why people lived, like Enoch was living, hundreds and hundreds of years, right? Methuselah, over 900 years. And then after the flood, things changed dramatically in the atmosphere. The waters in that greenhouse now descended in the flood, and things changed, okay? So none of that was there. He couldn't have envisioned what a flood would be like, what rain would look like. But not even having a framework to understand, he simply obeyed. And he gave more weight to God's words than to his own intuition. Notice what it says, verse 7, by faith Noah, being warned by God, concerning events as yet unseen, in reverent fear, constructed an ark. I don't think it was a fear of judgment. The nature of this term reflects, that's why I think it's the good translation, reverent fear. He had God spoke, and even though it made absolutely no sense and he had no categories in which to understand it, and there was nothing in the circumstances that would have given any indication that this was actually going to happen, when God spoke, Noah responded. He gave more weight to God's words than his own thought processes and intuitions. Again, he worked by faith. He exerted himself by faith. And some of you are in jobs like that, right? Where it's hard to see a light at the end of the tunnel. It's hard to see how anything good is coming out of this. And here's Noah again, laboring for 120 years, talk about wasting your life, on building a boat in the desert, Is this really going to materialize? And sometimes life is that way, isn't it? You can't see necessarily a great outcome. And we trust that God is going to honor our obedience. We have passages like 1 Corinthians 15. Your labor is not in vain in the Lord. What a great verse. The things that you exert yourself in, your work, your labors, are not for nothing. They're accomplishing something. And certainly Noah is a great example of that in his work. God commended Noah by preserving his family. The word commended isn't used there, but we've been trained to see the pattern established in verses 1 through 3, reiterated in verse 4, and again in verses 5 and 6 with Enoch. And the outcome of this, we know that Noah was commended because he was saved from the global flood. When we respond in faith, we witness against those who remain in unbelief, and we win a righteous standing. So again, at the end of this, there's sort of this summary statement about what's going on here. That's also been part of the pattern with these three individuals. And so, first of all, he becomes an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. So he receives, like Abel, right? He receives a righteous standing. He responds in faith, and God credits it to him as righteousness. God chalks it up as righteousness. So we have that same thing with Abel. It's reiterated here with Noah. He becomes an heir or a recipient of righteousness. It's not his own righteousness. It's not that he is so righteous, but he obeyed God, he responded in faith, and God made him an heir of righteousness. God bestowed righteousness on him. That's the salvation pattern, okay? It's repeated again and again. We stand before God not on our own righteousness, but on the imputed or credited righteousness of God. And then there's this other aspect here as well, that not only did his faith sort of accomplish something for him, but notice how it says that he, by his faith and by these actions, he condemned the world. There's also something going on here in which Noah's obedience and faith highlighted the unbelief around him, that no one was able to say that they didn't know about God's holiness, about God's coming judgment, that Noah served as a vehicle to help ultimately condemn those who chose to remain in unbelief. And a powerful concept in terms of the impact of our witness and our pattern of faith. I'm going to ask you to stand with me. Our time is gone. I want to pronounce a charge to you today as you leave and close our time in prayer. My brothers and sisters, God has revealed to us how to worship, how to walk, and how to work by faith. I urge you to go and live in the confidence of God's promises and His commands. They are steady. They are true. They are real. And may God grant you His grace to live by faith.